Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has been called a visionary in breaking down barriers between wealthy and poor, old and new, public and private, architect Teddy Cruz. Cruz believes that high-density ad hoc housing inspired by Latin American communities is a model for 21st century urbanism. His designs center on a mix of public and private space in close proximity, housing for multiple socioeconomic classes, in a grouping with community assets like vegetable gardens, social services and community centers, recreation, as well as local commerce. Cruz is the principal of Estudio Teddy Cruz and a professor of public culture and urbanism at the University of California, San Diego, where he's also the co-founder of the Center for Urban Ecologies. He won the Rome Prize in Architecture back in 1991. In 2008, he represented the U.S. in the Venice Architectural Biennial, and last year was a recipient of the Ford Foundation's Visionaries Award, named one of the most 50 influential designers in America. He'll be a guest of the American Institute of Architects and Philbrook Museum as a part of their Third Thursday program series tomorrow night from 6 to 8 at the museum. Teddy Cruz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I read something that you had written or said that the best ideas in architecture in the coming decades will not come from abundance and privilege, but from scarcity. Considering that most of the best ideas in architecture of the past century have come from abundance and privilege, that seems to be a very big change. And at the heart of your exploration and your work, what made you see things in that way?
Well, in reality, it became a very concrete evidence when I saw the explosion of urbanization in places such as Dubai, many Chinese metropolis or metropoli. In the last years of glamorous economy, a very strong economy, many projects happened in these environments, in these cities that were catapulted as the epicenters of development. Becoming global cities, but I was thinking that in reality, at the end of the day, there were not very many ideas that were advanced in terms of urbanization and even in architecture, besides the very iconic and very protagonistic projects. But instead, some of the most compelling ideas about architecture and urbanization were coming from Latin America, in fact, from places that suffer from a lot of violence, a lot of disinvestment in the past, a lot of dysfunctional institutions, in a sense. Places such as Curitiba in Brazil, Bogota in Colombia, Medellin, in fact. Medellin was a city that just a few years ago was considered the most dangerous city in the world and now has been presented as one of the most progressive cities in rethinking infrastructure of transportation, in rethinking housing, in rethinking really the investment of urbanization, which now has been happening in some of the most marginal zones. They decided that in order to really engage violence and ignorance forcefully, they needed to shift their gaze from investing only in the privileged environments, the predicted kind of environments where development happens, and instead move to the peripheries, move to the marginal communities to invest in an infrastructure of education and of public space and so on. So that's the reason I, on one hand, it's not really only a subjective interpretation of this, it's a very tangible evidence that some of the most progressive projects in the world having to do with rethinking housing and infrastructure and public institutions has been happening in these peripheral marginal zones in Latin America.
What changes in a community when you have enclaves of privilege and all of a sudden you open it up and you, if I'm using the metaphor of your fingers entwined, where you privilege and underprivilege come together in a space of bringing those forces from separation into inclusion?
Yes, and in reality, it's not to say that I'm trying to polarize or to add to the polarization of rich and poor. But in reality, some of the most important projects throughout our recent history in the last 100 years, some of the most fundamental transformations in the way we were thinking or engaging civic imagination occurred when governments were trying to rethink that relationship, that dramatic polarization between wealth and poverty. So that's all pretty much what I'm saying, in a sense, is that in the past, even in the United States, that really becomes an incredible laboratory at times to think about this. The reformation of institutions in engaging issues of inequality, issues of rethinking cultural and public institutions, etc., were already happening in this country not so long ago. I mean, everybody forgets that after the Great Depression, the New Deal emerged, the WPA program, Works Progress Administration, that really invested incredibly in a very visionary way, invested in the public realm as a kind of not only an economic engine, but really as a way of restoring a public imagination.
Yeah.
So it is that interface that is necessary at this moment, not only to benefit one sector of the society, but to really engage in the kind of in seeking issues of equality, in a sense, in terms of where, what are the sectors of the city that need to be taken care of at this moment, and not only for the sake of being socially, you know, responsible, but really to reimagine the economy as well. I've been arguing that in many of these marginal communities around the world, while suffering from disinvestment and poverty, these are the environments that really remain places of production, of social and cultural production, and at times of economic production through informal economies and so on. In other words, in places of socioeconomic emergency, creativity also flourishes. And that's the reason I've been arguing that it is that creativity that we need to, you know, to engage somehow.
Early in our conversation, you mentioned the new megacities of Dubai and Shanghai. And, you know, in the case of Dubai, it's created out of the desert. But in the case of Shanghai, you had a thriving city. What you saw was this, I think it was an incredible loss of sort of cultural heritage, because they basically just took the traditional neighborhoods of Shanghai, leveled them, and built skyscrapers in a lot of places.
Exactly.
What does the culture lose when they lose that sort of identity of, and because a lot of your designs are based on these very strong ideas of cultural identity and the way a cultural adapts to having just enough to do to build something, you know.
Yes, and this is at times a problem, you know, with many cities and many governments that want to immediately capture an image of progress as manifested, I guess, in the iconic and protagonistic character of skyscrapers and big bridges and huge, you know, infrastructures, when in reality they forget that in the fabric of very kind of granular fabric of neighborhoods, there is a huge importance also dwelling in the social fabric, in the socioeconomic and cultural relationships that are part of the construction of a community, that the city is not only built of buildings, but also, of course, of social relations and economic relations and
people,
of people ultimately, and that has been the interesting part of my research, is to really understand that the future of urbanization does not depend only, of course, on buildings and on the protagonism of architecture to claim some kind of place in the global stage for many cities, but really is about reconfiguring and reorganizing social and economic relations, that people and people's capacity to invent and to ultimately construct the spaces of their own neighborhoods is an amazing, you know, is based on an amazing process of creativity. So I've been interested in understanding neighborhoods as places of experimentation, as laboratories, to rethink many of the issues that really are of importance for us right now. I mean, rethinking housing and also public infrastructure. But again, the destruction of many neighborhoods around the world recently because of the, you know, the construction of these huge mega centers, I guess, seemingly of economic development, have subordinated and have ultimately forgotten the what made those neighborhoods that were destroyed possible. So that has been obviously part of my researches, and in many of those Asian cities, recently we did a project in Korea, for example, in South Korea, that involved understanding what made, I engaged activists in many neighborhoods in South Korea that were being destroyed, working with activists to really understand what is the value of the spaces that were being destroyed by the government and by developers, understanding the social and economic value of many of the amazing projects that happen inside those neighborhoods across informal economies. I mean, these environments are really rich with urban agriculture, with social activism, organizational practices that support small economies at the scale of the neighborhood. So in other words, the variety of social, environmental, you know, even pedagogical and cultural relations that are in the neighborhood could be devices to rethink the economy. And this is what really maybe is missing in our conversation. Mainly when, if the economy is going to be the main topic of conversation, we also need to understand that the economy is also based on small scales, not only the large corporate scale that we tend to seemingly uphold in this, you know, our notions of capitalism in this country. I think that we need to really understand that at smaller scales in neighborhoods, there is also emerging economies that might not be large, but nevertheless, you know, important to the sustainability of these communities.
Now, I want to ask you, how difficult is it to get a developer or say governmental officials to really see the social value of what I'm sure probably through their prism looks like substandard housing? In many cases, you know, I mean, that's sort of the economic value they would ascribe to a neighborhood like that, where you're looking at craft industry, working out of the home, that sort of thing. How do you get them to see the value of that?
You know, this is a thanks for that question, because that's probably one of the most important and critical sides of intervention, I guess, in my own practice, is really the rethinking of institutions. In other words, our institutions at this moment in general are really deficient in the way they can reinvent their own protocols. Many times I have said, you know, well, the type of stimulus packages that we've been witnessing in the past are very important to you know, to support the economy in some way. What is also necessary is a creativity stimulus. This is what I many times I say. In other words, a creativity stimulus, as this money might be smartly invested and reorganized in relationship to these issues. In other words, institutions need to bring into their own protocols new processes of research and investigation of relationship to these communities. Many of the processes by which these communities are measured and visualized are extremely deficient, because they tend to ignore, in fact, the kind of nuanced relationships on the ground that are very difficult to document. So yes, the project really at this moment, I think, is really very much about rethinking the ways by which you know, we understand many of these conditions that are embedded in these communities. So sometimes my own practice as an architect might not be only dealing with the designing of buildings, but also I begin to take a role of a facilitator and a kind of mediator to translate and interpret many of these conditions at the scale of social, again, you know, economic processes that might be off the radar of these planning institutions, so that we can begin to rethink the very nature of policy and economy of development at this moment. I mean, most of my research at the border between Mexico and the United States has had to do with the impact of immigrants in the United States in rethinking the American neighborhood, as many of the, I guess, informal densities and economies that happen in many depressed neighborhoods in San Diego or Southern California in the hands of immigrants. In other words, how immigrants tend to engage in urbanization of adaptation and retrofit, as they maybe plug an informal economy in a garage or build a granny flat to support an extended family. These alterations of space through informal actions can be the DNA to rethink land use and to really understand that these small acts, you know, these small retrofittings become really essential in terms of the kind of sustainability that we are talking about. So yes, the translation of this invisible socioeconomic and cultural activity at the scale of neighborhoods is still off the radar of many institutions.
My guest today is architect Teddy Cruz. He's a principal of a studio, Teddy Cruz, a professor of public culture and urbanism at the University of California, San Diego. He's co-founder there of the Center for Urban Ecologies. And he'll be a guest at the American Institute of Architects and Philbrook Museum of Art for their Third Thursday program tomorrow night, Thursday evening, from 6 to 8 o'clock. He'll be talking about this sort of creativity gap that we're talking about in our conversation today. And you, I'm glad you brought up your research, which is really focused on this border area between San Diego and Tijuana. And some of your ideas are really based on this idea of cross-cultural sharing. You said, I think at one point you said, I've watched people take these beautiful California bungalows, pick them up, you know, because they're going to build a McMansion somewhere in Southern California, and drive them across the border to Mexico. He says, why not bring some of their ideas, again, about this idea of these informal housing arrangements, and bring those ideas to the United States, this idea of retrofitting, of very informal housing. But I guess you're proposing this in a more formal style, because, you know, I can't imagine like the retrofitting of a place in Tijuana would pass zoning muster in Southern California.
Well, yes, it's not to say that this is about the literal translation or relation to these dynamics. I mean, I have been observing many of these very interesting phenomena that, again, as we discussed, is off the radar of institutions, but not for the sake of replicating that phenomena, because, of course, in many cases, much of that informal activity needs the support of a smarter policy and guarantees, I guess, and ways of translating that into new models, is not to translate it one-to-one. But nevertheless, it's compelling to witness it. On one direction, seeing immigrants retrofitting the one-dimensionality and the monocultural environments in San Diego, and on the other direction, into Mexico, into Tijuana, seeing how Tijuana builds itself in many ways with the waste of San Diego as they recycle many of the bungalows that are demolished in San Diego, much of the construction material that is wasted, to reorganize their own, to really build many of these slums in Tijuana. So this double journey, on one direction people and the other direction waste, I've been interested in researching much of those transactions and conditions. But at the basis of this whole thing is really understanding also that by comparing the stealth nature of this activity with the existing policy at this moment, with the existing exclusionary land use policies in Southern California that divides jurisdictions and uses bedroom communities that become hugely unsustainable because they lack mixed use, the lack of public transportation to create connectivity and efficiency, etc., all of the issues that we have gotten away from. When I compare those two things, I see a lot more dynamism. I see a lot more complexity and more a kind of more socially and economically interesting relationships embedded in those invisible, you know, activity. So, in essence, just to get to the point, I guess, for me, it's important to suggest that by understanding these informal, again, economies and densities reorganizing the city at this moment, we might begin to reimagine through that, through the understanding of that activity, and by translating it into a smarter policy, we might begin to rethink the very nature of zoning itself, because unfortunately zoning has become a punitive tool that denies sociability, in a sense, when in reality zoning, from its inception, it was understood as a generative tool that could organize activity and economy as well. So that's what I'm saying, is that we need to recuperate a more complex and a more inclusive and more organic idea of constructing a city. And I've seen that happening more in this, in these informal processes that we tend to denigrate as precarious, as dangerous,
substandard, as which
so, yeah,
yeah, that's what,
yes.
I think that's what most people would look at a lot of these communities as, but they have,
yes,
a strong sense of sociability. When I look at your designs, the designs I've seen, sociability is a big part of, you know, you have a variety of living conditions depending on your economic situation, but you're in very close proximity. You have lots of shared space, from gardens to parks to amphitheaters, where people come together. That's a big part of what I see in your work.
Yes. The interest is really in thinking that, you know, the careful and there's a careful design of spaces that can have the appropriate small infrastructure. Let's call it a collective kitchen. Let's call it an open air room connected to a vegetable garden, in relationship to maybe a local nonprofit organization that can occupy that site and that can curate certain social programs. In other words, this triangulation of spaces, programs, and people can begin to produce an interesting synergy that can support these aspects, again, of not only sociability but of economy. In other words, as architects, you know, they teach us in school to design beautiful buildings, but they never tell us who is going to manage and who is going to take care of those buildings in the long term. And it is that aspect of the curating of space in the hands of social organizations, partnering with communities, partnering with people themselves, and the infrastructure that really can support that activity is what I like to say. You know, many of the housing projects that we are working on are not just housing units spreaded through the territory. They are housing units that are threaded and embedded in an infrastructure of social service, small spaces, gardens, and incubating kinds of environments to really advance and translate much of that activity into new models of governance, into new models of pedagogy, of education, etc. It is that what I think is simply, I mean, it's not a big idea, but simply that's what is missing from our conversation, I think, is really the rethinking of public participation and of political representation of these interesting dynamics that are embedded in these environments.
Let me ask you about that idea of architects designing beautiful buildings, but not really thinking about how that space, once it's built, is going to be curated. Is this something that architects really need to be concerned about, our next generation of architects?
Yes, definitely. I think that's the reason architects have become subordinated, in a sense, to the developer's spreadsheet. I think that it used to be that architects were leading the conversation at some point in rethinking not only the identity but the very logic of infrastructure and of civic imagination, ultimately. And I'm thinking that the problem is that we have been exacerbating the idea that, again, architects only design things. But we, I think, can also engage the design of the conditions between things. And by that I mean we need to, as architects, also design political and economic processes, and why not to say it, also the kind of social relations that can really be conceptualized at the scale of these environments. So the expanding of our notions of design beyond objects, beyond things, into the designing of processes that engage a more social and economic inclusion, I think is really the most important topic we can talk about at this moment.
It's interesting that as you were describing this idea of social setting that you're describing, we have a development right by the University of Tulsa campus. It has been a marginalized area in a very poor socioeconomic zone that is changing. But one of the interesting things is they've developed a new housing program that involves housing for graduate students. There'll be mixed-use housing as far as socioeconomic. There'll be some that will be, you know, more expensive, others very modest, to get this mixing. There is a elementary school right nearby, a huge park, and attached to the elementary school is this sort of social service net for the neighborhood. It's called EduCare. Provides, you know, everything from, you know, socioeconomic help to medical help, and it's all right there. Is this the sort of idea that you're thinking about?
For sure. And again, that's the reason, I mean, these ideas are not new from this very conception. You know, the most important cities in the world for millennia have been made of that level of proximity and that level of complexity. It is only in many ways in the kind of selfish urbanization. In a sense, I don't want to sound awful here, but which is definitely American style in this case. I mean, I live in Southern California, which is the epicenter of a wasteful, selfish sprawl that has become finally unsustainable, clearly. And it is a return to the idea of a city that is a lot more compact, a lot smarter in terms of the type of complex adjacencies of services and relationships that really is at stake at this moment, definitely. So many times I say, that the future of Southern California depends on the pixelation of the large with the small, and by that I mean this sort of urbanization in steroids, that has been happening in the last years, has been depending on this very large scale sprawl and infrastructure, and somehow we need to begin to alter it with very small injections of program across social, economic, and cultural devices, and that's what you are describing, I think, happening there in the campus. And this is very interesting because also in my own campus at the University of California in San Diego, they're trying to rethink themselves so that campuses become a lot more diverse but also a lot more sustainable in the way that they can bring other uses into the campus, not only housing, classrooms, and offices, but really making them into ultimately very interesting urban laboratories by layering them with everything that you just mentioned.
Mm. Well, as you describe this sort of change that the American model is likely to have to see, if predictions hold true and our future is more of scarcity than abundance, you're looking at a major, major shift in the way American cities operate and how they help their citizens. Do you think we're capable of such a 180-degree change from building outward and to more sustainable?
I think that's exactly a critical reflection. And as I mentioned before, this has happened before in this country. We many times compare our own economic recession with the Great Depression because they are both moments in recent history where we have found the largest income inequality, the widest gap between rich and poor in this country. But we very seldom talk about what has happened or what happened after each of those periods. After the Great Depression in 1929, there was a return to what I would call a kind of engagement of a public imagination. I mean, as I was saying earlier, the kind of reformation of the institutions, the alliances between philanthropic, governmental, civil society spheres, trying to reinvest in infrastructure, trying to reinvest in neighborhoods, public housing emerges, public infrastructure, public parks. There is a very progressive taxation happening at that time. Everybody is willing to contribute to this construction of a more sustainable, at times, environment. In other words, we've witnessed that in our history. The problem with our own time at this moment is that we are going farther and farther away from that public imagination. In fact, public has become a forbidden word in this country. So, in a sense, it's not only to suggest that our future is about precariousness. Hopefully, it's not in terms of economy. That's a fundamental issue to continue working with. But that the economy that we are talking about that we need to recuperate is not only to benefit such a small sector of the society. It's about rethinking the distribution of those resources in more intelligent ways so that we can stop the kind of unrelenting privatization of public resources that we have been witnessing in the last decades that finally culminated in the crisis we have right now. So I think that it is about re-engaging a more intelligent, again, ideas about how we recuperate ultimately what has been missing in recent years. And it has to do a wider and more inclusive, again, notion of economy and of participation, of civic participation.
You can learn more at the Third Thursday program this Thursday from 6 to 8. Teddy, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Architect Teddy Cruz will be the guest for the Third Thursday program tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 at Philbrook Museum. Details at philbrook.org. That's Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher.